Job chapter 20, please. Job chapter 20. I want us to make an attempt to loosely expound chapters 20 through 21 as we're going through our series of studies in the book of Job. Now, in these studies, we've learned that there's something called retribution theology. Those who hold to this position believe that adversity and affliction are always the judgments of God on sinners. Peace and prosperity are only the blessings of God on the righteous, and there are no exceptions. In other words, God never blesses the wicked. He never brings adversity upon the righteous. In large measure, this is true. God's word does promise blessing those who walk in truth and judgment upon those who do not. But there are exceptions, and those exceptions are abundant. There are times when God allows adversity and affliction upon the righteous, even when they are living godly and holy lives. And Job is a classic example of that. But there are also times when he blesses the wicked with peace and prosperity, even when they have no time for God and his ways. And we'll see that tonight as Job responds to this man by the name of Zophar. In fact, Solomon recognized this in the book of Ecclesiastes. He says in chapter 7, verse 15, "I've seen all things in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness." He says similar things in chapter 8, verse 14, that there is a vanity of which occurs on the earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. Now, Job understood this, but his three friends did not. They held to the rigid and inflexible mindset that says adversity is the judgment of God on sinners. Hardship in unprecedented proportions came upon their friend Job, therefore he must be a sinner of unprecedented proportions. Zophar took this faulty theology to its extreme, which forced him into an unrealistic view of life and a denial of what you would see in life. He not only believed that God judges the wicked with adversity, but his judgments always come swiftly and quickly. The joy of the wicked is brief, and the children are left destitute. The sweetness of sin becomes bitter, and the prosperity they swallow down will be vomited up. The temporal prosperity and pleasures enjoyed by the wicked will be far outweighed by the severe judgment of God. Now, Job responds, and in doing so, contradicts many of the observations of Zophar by pointing out to the common experiences of life. The joy of the wicked is brief when measured by eternity, but many live long lives in this life and become very powerful. Their children and their grandchildren are many times well established. Many are financially secure, and their abundance is increased. They dance and sing in their homes. They live in luxury all the days of their lives, even though they have no use for God and his ways. Now, Job's perspective is basically true. As far as this life is concerned, God's judgment do not always come swiftly on the wicked. The wicked are often prosperous and enjoy long life. God is gracious to the wicked as well as the righteous. We need to grasp this, lest we be overcome when adversity comes upon us. Now, the speech by Zophar ends the second cycle of discourse between Job and his three friends. Even though Eliphaz and Bildad speak again in verse chapters 20 and chapter 25, Zophar does not. Therefore, this is his final speech. He does not enter into the third and final cycle. And it's probably a good thing he's probably run out of things to say, because I think after Job gets done dismantling his theology, he doesn't really have anything more to say. The outline is very similar to the ones that we've been considering. I want us to look at the substance of the final speech by Zophar, and then the response by Job to that final speech. First of all, the substance of that speech. His reaction to the previous rebukes by Job. Apparently, Zophar was very angry and insulted by what Job had said. especially when he told his friends that they should be looking for the sword of God's judgment on them rather than pointing their finger at Job. Look at chapter 19 and verse 29, where Job ends his discourse there by reminding his friends to be careful about pointing the finger of God's judgment that it may fall on them. Be afraid of the sword for yourselves. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. In response to this and other things, Zophar could not restrain himself from speaking. Look at chapter 20 and verse 1. Then Zophar the Nahamathite answered and said, "Therefore my anxious thoughts make the answer. Because of the turmoil within me, I have heard the reproof that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer." Then he launches into this unrealistic perspective of God's dealings with the wicked. He says, "The joy of the wicked is brief, and their children are left destitute." Verse 4. "Do you not know this of old, since man was placed on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens and his head reaches to the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuge. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He will fly away like a dream and not be found. Yes, he will be chased away like a vision of the night. That eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place behold him any more." Job, this has always been the case since the first man began to walk on this earth. It's an inflexible principle since time immemorial. The wicked are successful and might be highly exalted, but it's only momentary. He may be exalted to the heavens, but they soon come crashing down. And remember, by inference, they're applying this to Job. They may be prominent and wealthy and energetic, but they are worthless like dung, fleeting as a dream. They will be brought down to dust and soon forgotten. And he says their children will suffer. They will be left destitute and forced to beg. Verse 10, his children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will restore his wealth. Then he says the sweetness of sin becomes bitter, and the prosperity they swallow down will be vomited up. Look at verse 12. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he spares it and does not forsake it, but still keeps it in his mouth, yet his food is in his stomach turned sour. It becomes cobra venom within him. He swallows down riches and vomits them up. God casts him out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobra, and the viper's tongue will slay him. And he goes on and speaks in this way. The sins that they enjoy and the riches that they amass will soon seem joyous and sweet for a time, but like a child who eats too much candy, it's going to make them sick and they'll vomit it up. The things that seem good will become deadly to them like the venom of a cobra. Verse 17. He will not see the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. He will restore that for which he labored and will not swallow it down. For the proceeds of his business he will not get no enjoyment. For he is oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has violently seized a home which he did not build. They will never enter the land of true prosperity. Everything gained will have to be given up. They will never enjoy the fruits of their labors because they had no compassion for the poor and they confiscated property that was not theirs. Now that's a good description of the wicked, but I'm not sure that Zophar's perspective of it all is accurate, and we'll see that in a moment. Then he says the temporal prosperity and pleasures enjoyed by the wicked will be far outweighed by the severe judgments of God. Verse 20. Because he knows no quietness in his heart, he will not save anything he desires. Nothing is left for him to eat. Therefore, his well-being will not last. In his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come against him. When he's about to fill his stomach, God will cast on him the fury of his wrath and will rain it on him while he is eating. And he goes on to describe the further sufferings of the wicked. In summary, Zophar was saying, Job, you make my blood boil. You are insulting and you're arrogant. What I'm saying is known by everyone except you. Evil people perish quickly. They get what they ask for in the end. They may prosper for a while, but eventually it catches up to them. The judgment of God is coming in that right soon. Now, if Zophar was seeing all these things in the light of eternity, he couldn't dispute what he was saying. The final judgment of God will be devastating. The things that seem sweet and pleasant to the wicked in this life will be sour and bitter in eternity. James warns the rich of this in James 5. He says in verses 1 through 5, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your heart as in the days of slaughter." But Zophar does not have eternity in mind. His faulty theology forced him into an unrealistic view of life and the denial of common experience. He not only believed that God judges the wicked with adversity, but his judgments come quickly and swiftly in this life. Then you see the response to the final speech by Zophar in chapter 21. There's a rebuke of Zophar for his unrealistic perspective of God's dealing with the wicked in verses 1 through 5. Then Job answered and said, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your consolation. Bear with me that I may speak. And after I speak, have spoken, keep mocking. As for me, is my complaint against man? If it were, why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I'm terrified. And trembling takes hold of my life. Zophar, listen to what I'm saying. Let me tell you about the facts of life. What I have done, you can continue. When I'm done, you can continue to mock and ridicule me. I'm not complaining against man. Therefore, you have no reason to get upset. Look at me." And remember, Job was a hideous-looking creature now. With all of his flesh, he's lost weight, he's covered with these sores. He said he takes broken pieces of pottery and scrapes the pus and the worms out of his sores. He's living on an ash heap. He's an outcast of society. He says, "Look at me and take pity. When I think of what has happened to me, I'm still terrified by it." And then he begins to contradict certain aspects of Zophar's unrealistic perspective of God's dealing with the wicked. According to Job, Zophar had let his preconceived theological system blind him to the hard, cold facts of life. Basically saying, "Zophar, what planet do you live on? How can you live and move and have your being in this life and have such an unrealistic view of God's dealing with the wicked in this life?" Job then begins to contradict much of what Zophar said. "First of all, you said that the joy of the wicked is brief, but many live long lives and become very powerful." Look at verse 7. "Why do the wicked live and become old? Yes, become mighty in power." Zophar, what you're saying isn't always true. We know that there's people who are wicked people and they live long lives. They also occupy positions of great power. You said that their children will be left destitute, but their children and grandchildren are often well established. Verse 8. "Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. You said that their prosperity will be taken from them, but many are secure. I've seen no evidence of God's judgment upon them, and their abundance is increased." Verse 9. "Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them." I haven't seen God's rod of chastisement on them. "Their houses are safe and secure. Their bulls breed without failure. Their cows calf without miscarriage." So far, most of the men I met in the gates of the city, they enjoyed financial security. They had well-funded retirement programs. I saw no external evidences of God's judgment on them. Every time I walked by their fields, their herds got bigger and bigger. It was obvious that their bulls were virile and their cows did not lose their calves through miscarriage. Their herds just kept increasing. Fourthly, Zophar, you said that they never really enjoy life. But they dance and sing in their homes and live in luxury all the days of their life. And yet they have no use for God. I don't know about you, Zophar, but when my wife and I used to walk down the streets of Oz, we heard music. We heard people singing. We saw them dancing with joy in their homes. Some of my unsaved friends live in luxury all the days of their life. Verse 11. They send forth the little ones like a flock, and their children's dance. They sing to the tambourine and harp. They rejoice to the sound of the flute. They spend their days in wealth. They were not only unbelievers, Zophar, but they were profane. They wanted nothing to do with the Lord, yet they lived in peace and prosperity. Verse 14. Yet they said to God, "Depart from us, for we do not desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve Him? And what profit do we have if we pray to Him?" Then Job begins to question certain aspects of Zophar's unrealistic view of God's dealings with the wicked. Zophar, how often have you seen God strike down the wicked like you've described? Verse 17. How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? And how often does their destruction come upon them? And don't try and justify your position by claiming that God's judgment comes on the children rather than the wicked. A man should be judged for his own sins. Verse 19. They say, God lays up one's iniquity for his children. Let him recompense him that he may know it. Let him see, let his eyes see his destruction. Let him drink the wrath of the Almighty. Besides, how would the wicked man be affected by that kind of a judgment? What does he care after he's dead? Verse 21. What does he care about his household after him when the number of his months is cut in half? Now that might sound callous, but we all tend to think like this. We are careful. We care somewhat about what our children and grandchildren may have to face. But in reality, it's not something that we lose sleep over. Keep your finger in the text and go over to 2 Kings chapter 20. Let me show you the response of one of the more godly kings of Judah. When Isaiah the prophet come and told him that God was going to bring judgment upon the nation of Judah and upon Jerusalem. You might remember Hezekiah was dying of some kind of a disease, possibly cancer, with some kind of a boil. And he pleaded and cried to God that God would spare his life, and God gave him 17 more years. And the king of Babylon, son of Berodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, verse 12, after Hezekiah was made well, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah was attentive to them. They sent emissaries down, and he began to explain to him and show them all the tremendous wealth that he had in the city of Jerusalem. And Hezekiah was attentive to them and showed them all the house of his treasures, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious ointment, and all his armory, and all that was found among his treasury. There was nothing in his house or in all of his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, "What did these men say? And from where did they come to you?" Hezekiah said, "They came from a far country, from Babylon." And he said, "What have they seen in your house?" So Hezekiah answered, "They have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them." And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated unto this day shall be carried off to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. For he said, will there not be peace and truth at least in my days? In other words, Hezekiah says, all right, that's what's going to happen in the future. That's going to happen to my kids. But hey, it's going to be all right in my days. And that's basically what Job is saying as far as when they try to say that the judgment of God, if you don't see it fall on the wicked, will fall on the children. Job said that's not judgment at all, because once a man's dead, he's not going to care what happens to his children. Not only did he ask the question, how often do you see God strike down the wicked as described, but he says, what can anyone teach God since he's the judge of all? Verse 22, if you go back to our text. Chapter 21, verse 22. What can anyone teach God since he's the judge of all? Can anyone teach God knowledge since he judges those who are on high? Zophar, there are gross inequities in life that we can explain. We cannot explain and we do not understand. Verse 23. One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist. Another man dies in the bitterness of his soul, never having eaten with pleasure. They lie down alike in the dust. The worms cover them. And he goes on to say that, I know you have hidden motives, and that you're trying to ruin my reputation, for you look at my situation and say, look what happened to the greatest man of the East. It must be the judgment of God. Talk to those who have traveled around the world and see what they have to say. Verse 27. Look, I know your thoughts and the schemes which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the prince and where is the tent? Remember, Job lost everything, and that's a slap right at him. Have you not asked those who travel the road? And do you not know their signs? For the wicked are reserved for the day of doom. They shall be brought out on the day of wrath. Now, I kept looking at that and said, it doesn't seem to fit Job's argument. What he says is true, but it doesn't fit his argument. And I did some research and saw that some of the Hebrew scholars, I'm beginning to learn this, that apparently the Hebrew, and I know nothing of Hebrew, but the Hebrew language in Job is very, very difficult to translate in some places. In some places they cannot agree. The New International Version, and this is supported by some of the Greek scholars, have it this way, verses 29 through 30. Have you never questioned those who travel? Have you paid no regard to their accounts? That the wicked is spared from the day of calamity and he's delivered from the day of wrath. Not the day of calamity at the end times, not the day of wrath at the end times, but all of that Zophar was speaking about. Zophar, talk to those who travel around the world and they will tell you that they see wicked men who never have these things come upon them, ear scribing. There's the wicked that never have these things that you're talking about come upon it. Talk to these people that travel around the world and get some, broaden your perspective. Then he goes on to say, who confronts the wicked or tries to get revenge for what they've done? Yet when they die, they are shown respect. People flock to their funerals and pay them homage. Verse 31. Who condemns his way to his face? And who repays him? Who dares stand up against some of these wicked and powerful people and hold them accountable? Tell me who it is. Who repays him for what he has done? Who tries to get vengeance upon these people? They're afraid of him. When they die, even though they live wicked lives so far, they're given all kinds of respect and the people pay them homage. Yet he shall be brought to the grave and a vigil kept over the tomb. The clods of the valley shall be sweet to him. Everyone shall follow him as countless have gone before him. Zophar, how can you comfort me when you're wrong about so many things? How then can you comfort me with your empty words since falsehood remains in your answers? Zophar, you don't have idea what you're talking about. What you're saying is false. Therefore, how can you bring any comfort to me? Two lines of application I'd like to bring. Number one, the one we've already mentioned. There are aspects of God's dealing with man that we will never understand. and which raise questions for which there are no answers. There are aspects of God's dealing with man that we will never understand, and they raise questions for which there are no answers. We see that in verse 23. One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist. Another man dies in the bitterness of his soul, having never eaten with pleasure. Some enjoy good health all of their lives. Others never know a day without pain and suffering. Some enjoy all the advantages of life. Others just barely get by. Some are born into good families. Others are born with no families at all. Some are attractive. Others are not. Some have been given great minds and talents. Others are mentally impaired and have no talents at all. Some are born in a free country. Others in a country ruled by despots and murderers. And we, so far, there's no answer to these things. And we need to remember that too. Life is complicated. Life is filled with gross inequities. There are things that are beyond our understanding, and they raise questions that we cannot answer. This should not surprise us. God Himself has told us that finite creatures cannot comprehend His infinite ways. Look at Isaiah 55. It's a text that we're all familiar with. But it's good to remind ourselves of this when we fall into the temptation to begin to wonder, what in the world is God doing? What is God doing? It just doesn't make any sense. He says in chapter 55 and verse 8 of Isaiah, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." I've just struggled with this whole thing this past week. A friend of mine in the ministry, I've known for quite a few, I've known his parents, a godly man. Most everyone who knows him says that they've never met a more godly man. Devoted to his family, devoted to the Lord, devoted to the church. And yet you see that his church has dwindled down to a point where they've had to dismantle the church. And yet you see other men who stand in the pulpits who want to be in jail. They are nothing but charlatans. You turn your television on and you see these men manipulating people to get money and millions of dollars. You say, "Lord, what are you doing? Here's men of God that want to serve you, that love you, and their ministry is destroyed. Here are men who are ripping people off, using the gospel for their own selfish ends, and they seem to flourish. They seem to get on and get bigger and larger, and people are flocking and coming into their teaching and trying to, and believing in them." We have no answers to these things. And if we're foolish enough to try to figure it all out, we'll become like Job's friends. Especially when we're sitting down with someone and trying to comfort them and they're going through hard times. See, Job's friends thought they had it all figured out. To them, life was not complicated. It was all cut and dry. It was black and white. They believed that God always brings blessing on the righteous and brings sorrow only on the sinner. Job was suffering great adversity. Therefore, Job, you must be a great sinner. Not only were they wrong, but they exacerbated Job's suffering and inflamed God's wrath against him. When you're seeking to comfort those who are going through hard times and ask you why, don't fall into temptation of trying to always answer the question. Chuck Swindoll says, "We must learn that we cannot unscrew the inscrutable." We must all learn to give the only possible answer and probably the kindest answer that we can give, "I don't know." Because we don't know and we cannot know. Why is it that some, as Job said, live their whole life in prosperity and in good health, and others never enjoy a good day in their whole life? We don't know. And when you try to answer, sometimes you become foolish. I was watching several weeks ago, Dr. John MacArthur and a bunch of other, quote, theologians were on there being interviewed by Larry King. And they were trying to answer, well, if why would God allow those planes to fly into the World Trade Center? I heard some of the silliest statements made by these other theologians. This one Catholic priest said, well, you got to understand that God was doing all that he could do. I'm saying, God have mercy. Who'd want to trust your soul to a God like that? And then some other female theologian, well, our will, the will of man, is so inviolate, God cannot violate our own will. I said, Lord, have mercy. Why don't you just say, I don't know, and that's the end of it, because we don't know. I'm trying to learn this when it comes to a lot of the questions people ask me about theology or the Bible. Pastor Tom, where did sin come from? I don't know. Do you? I know when I used to go to ordination councils, that question would always get asked of the young man being ordained, because every pastor said, well, maybe this kid finally found the answer. Why does God allow earthquakes and tidal waves? I don't know. What does this verse mean? I don't know. When you don't know, you should say, I don't know. There are aspects of God's dealing with man that we will never understand, and which raise questions for which there are no answers. And sometimes when we step over that and try to answer a question asked by someone going through hard times, we end up doing more damage than we do to comfort them. But there's a second thing that we need to remember. I've mentioned this, but maybe we're not all familiar with this. There are aspects of God's grace that are enjoyed by the righteous and the wicked. There are aspects of God's grace that are enjoyed by the righteous and the wicked. It's what we call common grace. It's not a biblical term, but the concept is biblical. The grace God shows to all of mankind. There are several texts of Scripture, but because of time, I'll just look at these three most obvious ones. Look at Matthew chapter 5, please. See, this is what Zophar didn't understand. This is why he was so wrong and why he was so hard on Job. He could not in his mind ever believe that God would show any grace at all to the unsaved or to the wicked. But Jesus makes it clear that that's not the case in his Sermon on the Mount. He says in verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your enemy and hate your neighbor. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Notice, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. God shows common grace to all of his creation, sinner and saint alike. He says something rather similar in Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. It's in a similar context. But Luke even makes it more clear. And I'll just break into his line of thought in Luke 6, verse 35. Verse 35, but love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing in return. And your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the highest. For he is kind to the unthankful and evil. That's why we are to be kind even to those who hate us. Because that's the way God is. Look over to Acts chapter 14. Acts 14. Remember, this is what's called common grace. That God is gracious in some ways even to the unthankful and into the ungodly. Paul and Silas were in the city of Lystra, and they began to preach, and these people were steeped in idolatry. And they began to think that Paul and Barnabas were gods that came down from heaven. And they want to go and sacrifice to him. But look at verse 14 of chapter 14. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard this, they tore their clothes and ran among the multitude, crying and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these vain things to the living God, who made heaven and earth, the sea, and all the things that are in them, who in bygone days allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, giving us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Even though he let the nations walk in their own wickedness, he still showed kindness and grace to them in giving them rain and fruitful season and giving them food and filling their hearts with gladness." Common grace. There are aspects of God's grace that are enjoyed by the righteous and the wicked. Listen to me now. The sinner often sins against the saving grace of God by ignoring it. The believer often sins against the common grace of God by resenting it. Be aware of the temptation to resent the common grace of God when he chooses to bless sinners in a way that he doesn't bless you. This is especially true when you fall in hard times. Remember Psalm 73? When Asaph said, "I was almost overcome when I saw, when I was jealous of the prosperity of the wicked." And how he was almost overcome by that until he went into the sanctuary and saw their end. So beware of the temptation to resent the common grace of God when he chooses to bless sinners in a way that he doesn't bless you. Thirdly, be on guard against the temptation to resent the common grace of God when he chooses to bless other believers in a way he doesn't bless you. You may look at other people and see how they prosper. And you're not. Maybe you're just making ends meet and you begin to feel resentful. They're given certain spiritual gifts that you'd like to have, but you don't have those gifts, and you begin to get resentful. The mother and father with a large family looks over at the mother and father with a small family and says, "Why didn't God bless me with a smaller family?" Or the people with the small family look across the pew with the large family and say, "Why didn't God bless me with a larger family?" We can be thankful that God is gracious. He's gracious to us all, whether sinner or saint. But most of all, we thank you that he's gracious in saving our souls. He's gracious in all of his ways. Let's bow in prayer.